Okay, welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon on Shake and Wake Radio. I am Steve Roberts. This is Cancel Like a Ball. And I'm also on SoFlow Radio, PSN Radio, and EPGN Radio. And I do want to say that all the stations are listener supported, so please help them out if you can. I'm going to continue on. Don't really know how much longer it's going to last. And I may have to take a couple song break somewhere because dinner's going to be done sometime soon, probably the next half hour or so. It's actually done, but might have to take a couple of song break and get a little bite to eat instead of just like a single song or something. I'm sure I will be notified. I mean, I will be notified when that happens. See here. Kind of looking through here. I guess I got about 25 pages left until the end here, so 26, 27, somewhere in there. I stopped at the end of chapter 14 and starting on with chapter 15. Education in a Scientific Society. Sound level's okay, everyone? Hope they are. Education has two purposes. On one hand, to form the mind. On the other hand, to train the citizen. train the citizen. As in what John D. Rockefeller didn't want somebody to be educated. They wanted them to be able to just be smart enough to run their machines, in his words. The Athenians concentrated on the former, the Spartans on the latter. The Spartans won, but the Athenians were remembered. Education in a scientific society may, I think, be best conceived after the analogy of the education provided by the Jesuits. Oh, good grief. The Jesuits provided one sort of education for the boys who were to become ordinary men of the world, and another for those who were to become members of the Society of Jesus. In other words, the Masons, or some other skull and bones or whatever. In like manner, the scientific rulers will provide one kind of education for ordinary men and women, and another for those who are to become holders of scientific power. Ordinary men and women will be expected to be docile, industrious, punctual, thoughtless, and contented. You will eat bugs and you will be happy. Eat the bugs. Of these qualities, probably contentment will be considered the most important. In order to produce it, all of the researches of psychoanalysis, behaviorism, and biochemistry will be brought into play. Children will be educated from their earliest years in the manner which is found least likely to produce complexes. He was a little bit off there, I believe. Just a tad bit off. Almost all will be normal, happy, healthy boys or girls. Their diet will not be left to the caprices of parents. But they will be such as the best biochemist recommend. They will spend much time in the open air and will be given no more book learning than is absolutely necessary. Upon the temperament so formed, docility will be imposed by the methods of the drill sergeant, or perhaps by the softer methods employed by Boy Scouts. All the boys and girls will learn from an early age to be what is called cooperative, i.e. to do exactly what everybody is doing. Initiative will be discouraged in these children, and insubordination, being without being punished, will be scientifically trained out of them. Their education throughout will be a great part, in a great part, manual, and when their school years come to an end, they will be taught a trade. In deciding what trade they are to adapt, experts will appraise their aptitudes. Formal lessons, in so far as they exist, will be conducted by means of the cinema or in radio, so that one teacher can give simultaneous lessons in all the classes throughout a whole country. The giving of these lessons will, of course, be recognized as a highly skilled undertaking, reserved for the members of the governing class. All that will be required locally to replace the present-day school teacher will be a lady to keep order. Though it is hoping that the children will be so well behaved that they will seldom require this estimable person's services. Those children, on the other hand, who are destined to become members of the governing class will have a very different education. They will be selected, some before birth, some during the first 3 years of life, and a few before the ages of six, before the ages of 3 and 6. All of the best-known science will be applied to the simultaneous development of intelligence and willpower. Eugenics, chemical and thermal treatment of the embryo, and diet in early years will be used with a view to the production of the highest possible ultimate ability. The scientific outlook will be instilled from the moment that a child can talk, and throughout the early impressionable years, the child will be carefully guarded from contact with the ignorant and unscientific. From infancy up to 21, the scientific knowledge will be poured into him, and at any rate, from the age of 12 upwards, he will be specialized on all these sciences for which he shows the most aptitude. At the same time, he will be taught physical toughness. He will be encouraged to roll naked in the snow, to fast occasionally for 24 hours, to run many miles in hot days, to be bold in all physical adventures, and uncomplaining when he suffers physical pain. From the age of 12 upwards, he will be taught to organize children slightly younger than himself, and will suffer severe censure if groups of such children fail to follow his lead. A sense of his high destiny will be constantly set before him, and loyalty towards his order will be so axiomatic that it will never occur to him to question it. Every youth will thus be subjected to a threefold training in intelligence, in self-command, and in command over others. If he should fail in any of these three, he will suffer the terrible penalty of degradation to the ranks of common workers, and be condemned for the rest of his life to associate with men and women vastly inferior to himself in education and probably in intelligence. I thought the way he was talking in the last chapter there, they were going to weed out them, these type of people, these inferiority and education and intelligence. Maybe I was mistaken. I thought they were talking about abortion in the last chapter there. The spur of this fear will suffice to produce industry in all but a very small minority of boys and girls of the governing class. Except for the one matter of loyalty to the world, state, and to their own order, Members of the governing class will be encouraged to be adventurous and full of initiative. It will be recognized that it is their business to improve scientific technique and to keep manual workers contented by means of continual new amusements, as these upon whom all progress depends. They must not unduly tame, nor so drilled as to be incapable of new ideas. Unlike the children destined to be manual workers, they will have personal contact with their teacher, and will be encouraged to argue with him. It will be his business to prove himself in the right if he can, and if not, to acknowledge his error gracefully. There will, however, be limits to intellectual freedom, even among the children of the governing class. They will not be allowed to question the value of science or the division of the population into manual workers and experts. They will not be allowed to coquette with the idea that perhaps poetry is as valuable as machinery, or love as good a thing as scientific research. If such ideas do occur to any venturesome spirit, they will be received in a painful silence, and there will be a pretense that they have not been heard. A profound sense of public duty will be instilled into boys and girls of the governing class as soon as they are able to understand such an idea. They will be taught to feel that mankind depends upon them, and if they owe benevolent service, especially to the less fortunate classes beneath them. But let it not be supposed that they will be prigs, far from it. They will turn off with a deprecating laugh any two portentous remark that puts into explicit words what they will all believe in their hearts. Their manners will be easy and pleasant, and their sense of humor unfailing. The last stage of the education of the most intellectual of the governing class will consist of training for research. Research will be highly organized. The young people will not be allowed to choose what particular piece of research they shall do. They will, of course, be directed to research in those subjects for which they have shown special ability. A great deal of scientific knowledge will be concealed from all but a few. Yep, you got that one right. There will be arena reserved for the priestly class of researchers, who will be carefully selected by their combination of brains and loyalty, brains with loyalty. Be a good little drone. You shall be assimilated. Resistance is futile. One may, I think, expect that research will be much more technical than fundamental. The men at the head of any department of research will be elderly and content to think that the fundamentals of their subject are sufficiently known. Discoveries which upset the official view of the fundamentals, if they are made by young men, will incur disfavor, and if rashly published, will lead to degradation. Young men to whom the fundamental innovations occur will make cautious attempts to persuade their professors to view the new ideas with favor. But if any of these attempts fail, they will conceal their new ideas until they themselves have acquired positions of authority, by which time they will probably have forgotten them. How do you forget your ideas? Especially if you're smart enough to write them down, you're not going to forget them. The atmosphere of authority and organization will be extremely favorable to technical research, but somewhat inimical to such subversive innovations as have been seen. For example, in physics during the present century, there will be, of course, an official metaphysic, which will be regarded as intellectually unimportant, but politically sacrosanct. In the long run, the rate of scientific progress will diminish and discovery will be killed by respect for authority. You could manage what one? What did I miss, Annie? As for the manual workers, they will be discouraged from serious thought. They will be made as comfortable as possible, and their hours of work will be much shorter than they are at present. They will have no fear of destitution or of misfortune to their children. As soon as working hours are over, amusements will be provided of a sort calculated to cause wholesale mirth and prevent any thoughts of discontent while otherwise might cloud their happiness. Oh, okay. You gotta write them down, like I do. On those rare occasions when a boy or girl who has passed the age at which it is usual to determine social status shows such marked ability as to seem the intellectual equal of the rulers, a difficult situation will arise, requiring serious consideration. If the youth is content to abandon his previous associates and to throw in his lot wholeheartedly with the rulers, he may, after a suitable test, be promoted. But if he shows any regrettable solidarity with the previous associates, the rulers will reluctantly conclude that there is nothing to be done with him, except send him to the lethal chambers before his ill-disciplined intelligence has had any time to spread revolt. Sounds like modern-day China to me, and China of the 50s, 60s, 70s, all through today. This will be a painful duty to the rulers, but I think they will not shrink from performing it. In normal cases, children of sufficiently excellent hereditary will be admitted into the governing class from the moment of conception. I start with this moment rather than with birth, since it is from this moment and not nearly from the moment of birth that the treatment of the two classes will be different. If, however, by the time the child reaches the age of 3, it is fairly clear that he does not attain the required standard, he will be degraded at that point. I assume that by that time it will be possible to judge of the intelligence of a child of 3 with a fair measure of accuracy. Cases in which there is doubt, which should, however, be few, will be subject to careful observation up to the age of 6, at which moment one supposes the official decision will be possible, except in a few rare instances. Conversely, children born of manual workers may be promoted at any time between the age of 3 and 6, but only in quite rare instances at later ages. I think it may be assumed, however, that there would be a very strong tendency for the governing class to become hereditary, and after a few generations, not many children will be moved from either class to the other. This is especially likely to be the case of embryological methods of improving the breed are applied in the governing class, but not to the others. In this way, the gulf between the two classes as regards native intelligence may become continuously wider and wider. This will not lead to the abolition of the less intelligent class, since the rulers will not wish to undertake uninterestingly manual work, or to be deprived of the opportunity for exercising benevolence and public spirit, which they derive from the management of the manual workers. It was a very quick chapter, because we're on to chapter 16, Scientific Reproduction. Yes, painful duty of the rulers. How such meaningless, trivial workers. They have to exude their power and authority over them. Mark. That's Roger. I know it's Roger. I know his number, and he's calling me before. I'm going to take a quick break and call him right back. Let's see what's going on. Be right back, everyone. Okay, I'm back for a couple of minutes here. He apologizes for the interruption. He forgot what time my show goes from what to what. Normally he calls it 6, just a few minutes after 6. He forgot today. Okay, let's see if I can find my place. I think I had just gotten into chapter 15. 16. Scientific reproduction. Science, when it has once acquired a firm hold upon social organization, is hardly likely to stop short at these biological aspects of human life, which have hitherto been left to the joint guidance of religion and instinct. We may, I think, assume that both the quantity and the quality of the population will be carefully regulated by the state, but that sexual intercourse, apart from children, will be regarded as a private matter, so long as it is not allowed to interfere with work. As regards quantity, the state statisticians will determine as carefully as they can whether the population of the world at the moment is above or below the number which leads to the greatest material comfort per hand. They will also take account of all such changes of technique as can be foreseen. No doubt the unusual rule will be to aim at the stationary population. But if some important invention, such as artificial food, should greatly cheapen the production of necessities, an increase of population might be for the time be thought wise. I shall, however, assume that in normal times the world government will decree a stationary population. If we were right in supposing that the scientific society will have different social grades according to the kind of work to be performed, we may assume also that it will have uses for human beings who are not of the highest grade of intelligence. It is probable that there will be certain kinds of labor mainly performed by Negroes, and that manual workers in general will be bred for patience and muscle rather than for brains. The governors and experts, on the contrary, will be bred chiefly for their intellectual powers and their strength of character, assuming that both kinds of breeding are scientifically carried out. There will come to be an increasing divergence between the two types, making them, in the end, almost different species. All right, mark my spot there. Take the official break. I guess I could play the two songs I was going to play there a few minutes ago, so be right back in about 5 minutes, everyone.
The Father waits over the way.
Okay, welcome back. That's probably one of my favorite songs. By anyone, doesn't matter. And I do want to say again that all the stations are listener supported, so please help them out if you can. Scientific breeding in any truly scientific form would be a present encounter. Insuperable obstacles, both from religion and from sentiment. To carry it out scientifically, it would be necessary, as among domestic animals, to employ only small percentages of males for purposes of breeding. It may be thought that religion and sentiment will always succeed in opposing an immovable veto to such a system. I wish I could think so, but I believe the sentiment is quite extraordinarily plastic, and that the individualistic religion to which we have been accustomed is likely to be increasingly replaced by a religion of devotion to the state. Among Russian communists, this has already happened. In any case, what is demanded is scarcely as difficult, the control of natural impulses, as is involved by the celibacy of the Catholic priesthood. Wherever remarkable achievements are possible and are at the same time such as to satisfy men's moral idealism, the love of power is capable of swallowing up the instinctive life of the affections, especially if an outlet is permitted to purely physical sexual impulses. Traditional religion, which has been violently disposed in Russia, will suffer a setback everywhere if the Russian experiment proves successful. If any case, its outlook is difficult to reconcile, while that and industrialism and scientific technique. It's difficult to reconcile with that of industrialism and scientific technique. Traditional religion was based upon a sense of man's impotence in the face of natural forces, whereas scientific technique induces a sense of impotence of the natural forces in face of man's intelligence. Combined with any sense of power, a certain degree of austerity in the regard to the softer pleasures is quite natural. One sees it already in many of these who are creating the mechanistic society of the future. In America, this austerity has taken the form of Protestant piety. In Russia, of devotion to communism. I think, therefore, that there is hardly any limit to the departures from traditional sentiment which science may introduce into the question of reproduction. If the simultaneous regulation of quality and quantity and quality is taken seriously in the future, we may expect that in each generation, some 25% of women and some 5% of men will be selected to be the parents of the next generation, while the remainder of the population will be sterilized, which will in no way interfere with their sexual pleasures, but will merely render their pleasures destitute of social importance. The women who are selected for breeding will have to have 8 or 9 children each, but will not be expected to perform any other work except the suckling of the children for a suitable number of months. No obstacles will be placed upon their relations with sterile men, or upon the regulations upon the relations of sterile men and women with each other, but reproduction will be regarded as a matter which concerns the state and will not be left to the free choice of persons concerned. Perhaps it will be found that artificial impregnation is more certain and less embarrassing, since it will obviate the need for any personal contact between the father and mother of the prospective child. Sentiments of personal affection will still be connected with intercourse not intended to be fruitful, while impregnation will be regarded as an entirely different matter, more in the light of surgical operation, so that it will be thought not ladylike to have it performed in a natural manner. The qualities for which parents will be chosen will differ greatly according to the status which it is hoped the child will occupy. In the governing class, a considerable degree of intelligence will be demanded of parents. Perfect health will, of course, be indispensable. So as long as gestation is allowed to persist to its natural period, mothers also will also have to be selected by their capacity for easy delivery, and will therefore have to be free from the unduly narrow pelvis. It is probable, however, that as time goes on, the period of gestation will be shortened, and the later months of fetal development will take place in an incubator. This would also free mothers from the need of suckling their children, and would thus make maternity a not very onerous matter. The care of infants intended to belong to the governing class would seldom be left to the mothers. Mothers would be selected by their eugenic qualities, and these would not necessarily be the qualities required in a nurse. On the other hand, the early months of pregnancy might be more burdensome than at present, since the fetus would be subjected to various kinds of scientific treatment intended to the effect beneficially not only as its characteristics, but those of its possible descendants. Fathers would, of course, have nothing to do with their own children. That's awful nice of these people. There would be, in general, only one father to every five mothers, and it is quite likely that he would never have seen the mothers of his children. The sentiment of paternity would thus disappear completely. Probably in time, the same thing would happen, through a slightly less degree, in regards to mothers. If birth were prematurely induced, and the child separated from its mother at birth, maternal sentiment would have little chance to develop. Well, he's an outstanding fella here. I can see that. Among the workers, it is probable that less elaborate care would be taken, since it is easier to breed for muscle than to breed for brains, and it is not unlikely that women would be allowed to bring up their own children in an old-fashioned natural manner. There would not be among the workers the same need as among the governors for fanatical devotion to the state, and there would not be, therefore, on the part of the government, the same jealousy of the private affections. Among the governors, one must suppose all private sentiments would be viewed as suspicion. A man and woman who showed his ardent devotion to each other would be regarded as they are present, regarded by the moralists when they are not married. There would be professional nurses and creches, whatever that word is, C-R-E-C-H-E-S, crutches, and professional teachers in nursery schools, but they would be considered to be failing in their duty if they felt any special affection for special children. Children who showed any special affection for the particular adult would be separated from that adult. Ideas of this kind are already widespread. They would be found suggested, for example, in Dr. John B. Watson's book on education, the tendency of the scientific manipulator is to regard all private affections as unfortunate. Freudians have shown us that they are the sources of complexes. Administrators realize that they stand in the way of wholehearted devotion to business. The church sanctions certain kinds of love while condemning others, but the modern ascetic is more thoroughgoing and condemns all kinds of love equally as mere folly and the waste of time. What should we expect of the mental makeup of people in such a world? The manual workers may, I think, be fairly happy. One may assume that the rulers will be successful in making the manual workers foolish and frivolous. Work will not be too severe, and there will be endless amusements on the trivial sort. Owing to sterilization, love affairs need not have awkward consequences, so as long as they are not between a man and a woman who are both of them sterilized. In this way, a life of easygoing and frivolous pleasure may be provided by the manual workers, combined, of course, with those superstitious revenge of the governors instilled in childhood and prolonged by the propaganda to which adults will be exposed. Well, Mom, I was hoping when I learned about all this stuff 14 years ago that I wouldn't see it in my lifetime, but who knows? In such a case, the authorities will separate the friends, unless in doing so they will interrupt some important research or administrative undertaking. When for some such public reasons friends are not separated, they will be admonished. By means of governmental microphones, the censors will listen in to the conversations. Boy. 1984, 10 years before it was written. By means of governmental microphones, the censors will listen in on their conversations. And if these should at any time become tinged with sentiment, disciplinary measures will be adopted. All the deeper feelings will be frustrated, with the sole expectation of devotion to service and the state. It is 1984, 10 years before it was written. The governors will, of course, have their amusements for leisure hours. I do not see how art and literature could flourish in such a world, nor do I think that the emotions from which they spring and to which they appeal would meet the governmental approval. But athletes of a strenuous kind will be encouraged among the young of the governing class, and dangerous sports will be considered valuable as a training in those habits of mind and body by which authority over the manual workers will be maintained. Lovemaking among the sterilized will be subjected to no restrictions either of law or of public opinion. but it will be casual and temporary, involving none of the deeper feelings and no serious affection. Persons suffering from unendurable boredom will be encouraged to ascend Mount Everest or fly over the South Pole, but the need for such distractions will be regarded as a sign of mental or physical ill health. In such a world, there may be pleasure. There will be no joy. The result will be a type of displaying the usual characteristics of vigorous ascetics. They will be harsh and unbending, tending towards cruelty in their ideals and their readiness to consider that the affliction of pain is necessary for the public good. I do not imagine that pain will be much inflicted as punishment for sin, since no sin will be recognized except in subordination and failure to carry out the purposes of the state. It is more probable that the sadistic impulses which the asceticism will generate will find their outlet in scientific experiment. The advantage of knowledge will be held to justify much torture of individuals by surgeons, biochemists, and experimental psychologists. As time goes on, the amount of added knowledge required to justify a given amount of pain will diminish, and the number of governors attracted to the kinds of research necessitating cruel experiments will increase. Just as the sun worship of the Aztecs demanded the painful death of thousands of human beings annually, so the new scientific religion will demand its holocaust of sacred victims. Gradually, the world will grow more dark and more terrible. So true. Strange perversions of instinct will first lurk in the dark corners and then gradually overwhelm the men in high places. Sadistic pleasures will not suffer the moral condemnation that will be meted out of the softer joys, since, like the persecutions of the Inquisition, they will be found in harmony with the prevailing asceticism. In the end, such a system must break down either in an orgy or bloodshed or in the rediscovering of joy. I'm going to take a couple seconds here and adjust my microphone. Guess I can turn a page before I get ready for it, so it doesn't take so long. Such, at least, is the only ray of hope to lighten the darkness of these visions of Cassandra. But perhaps in permitting this ray of hope, we have allowed ourselves to yield to a foolish optimism. Perhaps by means of injections and drugs and chemicals, the population could be induced to bear whatever its scientific masters may decide to be for its good. New forms of drunkenness involving no subsequent headache may be discovered, and new forms of intoxication may be invented so delicious that for their sakes, men are willing to pass their sober hours in misery. All these are possibilities in a world governed by knowledge without love and power without delight. A man drunk with power is destitute of wisdom. And so long as he rules the world will be a place devoid of beauty and of joy. So true today. Okay, that was another quick chapter. on to chapter 17, Science and Values. Science and Values. I bet this is going to be a hoot. I'm going to take a quick drink here and then read for a couple minutes. Yeah, I'll bet this one's going to be a hoot. Science and Values. The scientific society, which has been sketched in the chapters of this part, is, of course, not to be taken altogether as serious prophecy. It is an attempt to depict the world which would result in scientific technique, were to rule unchecked. The reader will have observed that features that everyone would consider desirable are almost inextricably mingled with features that are repulsive. The reason of this is that we have been imagining a society developed in accordance with certain ingredients of human nature to the exclusion of all others, as ingredients as they are good. As a sole driving force, they are likely to be disastrous. That's the truth. The impulse towards scientific construction is admirable when it does not thwart any of the major impulses that give value to human life, but when it is allowed to forbid all outlet to everything but itself, it becomes a form of cruel tyranny. There is, I think, a real danger lest the world should become subject to a tyranny of this sort, and it is on this account that I have not shrunk from depicting the darker features of the world that scientific manipulation unchecked might wish to create. Alrighty, I marked my spot. Well, don't have to mark my spot, it's at the end of a page, so take another break here. Second hour coming up, everyone. And I'm probably going to get through this book today. So that is a good thing. Let me see here. I think I did not play this song. So I'm going to play this one here, about 5.5 minutes, everyone. Be right back.
Could see what I once was. If you could go with me back to where I started from, then I know you would see a miracle of love. And made me what I am today.
Okay, and welcome back to the final hour of Cancel the Cabal on Shake and Wake Radio, PSN Radio, EPGN Radio, and SoFlo Radio. And once again, all of the stations could use your support. That would be ending nearly 2 weeks in a row, Annie. Last week, I made a mistake. And ended a half hour early when I could have, I could have done a little bit more. Here we go. Science and values. Science, as the course of a few centuries of its history, has undergone an external, internal development, which appears to be not yet completed. One may sum up this development as a passage from contemplation to manipulation. The love of knowledge to which the growth of science is due in itself the product of a twofold impulse. We may seek knowledge of an object because we love the object or because we love to have power over it. The former impulse leads to the kind of knowledge that is contemplative, the latter to the kind that is practical. In the development of science and power, impulse has increasingly prevailed over the love impulse. The power impulse is embodied with industrialism and in governmental technique. It is embodied also in the philosophies known as pragmatism and instrumentalism. Each of these philosophies holds, broadly speaking, that our beliefs about any object are true insofar as they enable us to be manipulated with advantage to ourselves. This is what may be called the governmental view of truth. of truth so conceived, science offers us a great deal. Indeed, there seems no limit to its possible triumphs. To the man who wishes to change his environment, science offers astonishingly powerful tools. And if knowledge consists in the power to produce intended changes, then science gives knowledge in abundance. But the desire for knowledge has another form, belonged to an entirely different set of emotions. The mystic, the lover, and the poet, also seekers after knowledge, not perhaps very successful seekers, but nonetheless worthy of respect on that account. In all forms of love, we wish to have knowledge of what is loved, not for purposes of love, of power, but for the ecstasy of contemplation. If knowledge of God standeth our eternal life, but not because knowledge of God gives us power over him. However, there is ecstasy or joy or delight derived from an object, that is, the desire to know that object, to know it not in the manipulative fashion that consists of turning it into something else, but to know that it is the fashion of the beatific vision, because in itself and for itself it sheds happiness upon the lover. In sex, love, as in other forms of love, the impulse to this kind of knowledge exists, unless the love is purely physical or practical. This may indeed be made the touchstone of any love that is valuable. Love which has value contains an impulse towards a kind of knowledge out of which the mystic union springs. Science, in its beginnings, was due to men who were in love with the world. They perceived the beauty of the stars and the sea, of the winds and the mountains, because they loved them, their thoughts dwell upon them, and they wished to understand them more intimately than a mere outward contemplation made possible. The world said, Heraclitus is as ever-living fire with measures kindling with measures going out. Didn't make much sense to me, but Heraclitus, that's what that word is. That's what his name was, Heraclitus. And the other Ionian philosophers, from whom came the first impulse of scientific knowledge, felt the strange beauty of the world almost like a madness in the blood. They were men of titanic passion, passionate intellect, and from the intensity of their intellectual passion, the whole movement of the modern world has sprung. But step by step, as science has developed, the impulse of love which gave it birth has been increasingly thwarted. While the impulse of power, which was at first a mere camp flower, has gradually usurped command in virtue of its unforeseen success, the lover of nature has been baffled, the tyrant over nature has been rewarded. As physics has developed, it has deprived us step by step of what we thought we knew concerning the intimate nature of the physical world. Color and sound, light and shade, form and texture belong no longer to the external nature that the Ionians sought as the bride of their devotion. All these things have been transferred from the beloved to the lover, and the beloved has become a skeleton of rattled bones, cold and dreadful, but perhaps a mere phantasm. The poor physicist, appalled at the desert that their formulae have revealed, call upon God to give them comfort But God must share the ghostliness of his creation. And the answer that the physicist thinks they hear to their cry is only the frightened beat of their own hearts. Disappointed as a lover of nature, the man of science is becoming its tyrant. What matters it, says the practical man, whether the outer world exists or in a dream, provided I can't make it behave as I wish. Thus science has more and more substituted power knowledge for the love knowledge. And as this substitution becomes completed, science tends more and more to become sadistic. The scientific society of the future, as we have been imagining it, is one in which the power impulse has completely overwhelmed the impulse of love, and this is the psychological source of the cruelties which it is in danger of exhibiting. Science, which became as the pursuit of truth, is becoming incompatible with veracity, since complete veracity tends more and more to complete scientific skepticism. When science is considered contemplatively, not practically, we find that what we believe owing to animal faith. And it is only our disbeliefs that are due to science. When, on the other hand, science is considered as a technique for the transformation of ourselves and other environment, it is found to give us a power quite independent of its metaphysical validity. But we can only wield this power by ceasing to ask ourselves metaphysical questions as to the nature of reality. Yet these questions are the evidence of a lover's attitude towards the world. Thus it is only in so far as we renounce the world as its lovers that we can conquer it as its technicians. But this division of the soul is fatal to what is best in man. As soon as a failure of science considered as metaphysics is realized, the power conferred by science as a technique is only obtainable by something analogous to the worship of Satan, that is to say, by the renunciation of love. This is the fundamental reason why the prospect of a scientific society may be viewed with appreciation, with apprehension. The scientific society in its pure form, which is what we have been trying to depict, is incompatible with the pursuit of truth, with love, with art, with spontaneous delight, and with every ideal that man have hitherto cherished, with the sole exception of ascetic renunciation. It is not knowledge that is the source of these dangers. Knowledge is good and ignorance is evil. To this principle, the lover of the world can admit no exception, nor it is power in it, in and for itself, that is the source of danger. What is dangerous is power wielded for the sake of power, not power wielded for the sake of genuine good. The leaders of the modern world are drunk with power. In fact, they can do something that no one previously thought it possible to do is to them a sufficient reason for doing it. Power is not one of the ends of the life, but merely a means to other ends. And until men remember the ends of that power should subserve science will not do what it might to minister to the good life. But what then are the ends of life? The reader will say, I do not think that one man has a right to legislate for another on this matter. For each individual, the ends of life are those things which he deeply desires, and which, if they exist, would give him peace. Or, if it be thought that peace is too much to ask this side of the grave, let us say the ends of life should give delight or joy or ecstasy, and the conscious desires of man who seeks power for its own sake, there is something dusty. When he has it, if he wants only more power and does not find rest in contemplation of what he has, the lover, the poet, and the mystic find a fuller satisfaction than the seeker after power can ever know, since they can rest in the object of their love, whereas the seeker after power must be perpetually engaged in some fresh manipulation. If he is not to suffer from a sense of emptiness, I think, therefore, that the satisfactions of the lover, using the word in its broadest sense, exceed the satisfactions of the tyrant, and deserve a higher place among the ends of life. When I come to die, I shall not feel that I have lived in vain. I have seen the earth turn red at evening, the dew sparkling in the morning, and the snow shining under a frosty sun. I have smelt rain after drought, and have heard the stormy Atlantic beat upon the granite shores of Cornwall. Science may bestow these and other joys upon more people than could otherwise enjoy them. If so, its power will be wisely used, but when it takes out of life the moments to which life owes its value, science will not deserve admiration. However cleverly and however elaborately it may lead men among the road to despair, the sphere of values lies outside science, except in so far as science consists in the pursuit of knowledge. Science as a pursuit of power must obtrude upon the sphere of values in scientific technique, if it is to enrich human life, must not outweigh the ends which it should serve. The number of men who determine the character in an age is small. Columbus, Luther, and Charles V dominated the 16th century. Galileo and Descartes governed the 17th. The important men in the age that ended about 1930 are Edison, Rockefeller, Lenin, and Sun Yat-sen. With the exception of Sun Yat-sen, these were men devoid of culture, contemptuous of the past, self-confident, and ruthless. Traditional wisdom had no place in their thoughts and feelings. Mechanism and organization, what interested them? A different education might have made all these men quite different. Edison might be, in his youth, have acquired a knowledge of history and poetry and art. Rockefeller might have been taught how he had been anticipated by Croesus and Croesus and Crassus. Lenin, instead of having hatred implanted in him with the execution of his brother during his student days, might have made himself acquainted with the rise of Islam and the development of Puritanism, from piety to plutocracy. By means of such education have leaven of doubt might have entered the souls of these great men. Given a little doubt, their achievement would perhaps have been less in volume, but much greater in value. Our world has a heritage of culture and beauty, but unfortunately, we have been handling on this heritage only to the less active and important members of each generation. The government of the world, by which I do not mean its ministerial posts, but its key positions of power, has been allowed to fall into the hands of men ignorant of the past, without tenderness towards what is traditional, without understanding of what they are destroying. There is no essential reason why this should be the case. To prevent it is an educational problem, and not a very difficult one. Men of the past were often parochial in space, but the dominant men of our age are parochial in time. They feel for the past a contempt that it does not deserve, and for the present day respect that it deserves still less. The copybook maxims of the former age have become outworn, but a new set of copybook maxims is required. First among these I should put, it is better to do a little good than much harm. To give content to this maxim, it would, of course, be necessary to install some sense of what is good. Few men in the present day, for example, can be induced to believe that there is no inherent excellence in rapid locomotion. To climb from hell to heaven is good, though it be a slow and laborious process. To fall from heaven to hell is bad, even though it is done with the speed of Milton's Satan. Nor can it be said that a mere increase in the production of material commodities in itself a thing of great value. To prevent extreme poverty is important, but to add to the possessions of those who already have too much is a worthless waste of effort. To prevent crime may be necessary, but to invent new crimes in order to that the police may show skill in preventing them is less admirable. The new powers that science has given man can only be wielded safely by those who, whether through the study of history or through their own experience of life, have acquired some reverence for human feelings and for some tenderness towards the emotions that give color to the daily existence of man and woman. I do not mean to deny that scientific technique may in time build an artificial world in every way preferable to that in which men have hitherto lived. But I do say that if this is to be done, it must be done tentatively and with realization that the purpose of government is not merely to afford pleasure to those who govern, but to make life tolerable for those who are governed. Scientific technique must no longer be allowed to form the whole culture of the holders of power, and it must become as essential part of man's ethical outlook to realize that the will alone cannot make a good life. Knowing and feeling are equally essential ingredients, both in the life of the individual and in that of the community. Knowledge, if it is wide and intimate, brings with it in a realization of distant times and places, and awareness that the individual is not omnipotent or all-important, and a perspective in which values were seen more clearly than by those of whom a distant view is impossible. Probably about a minute and a half or 2 minutes there, Annie. I think right about the half-hour break is when I'll be done with this, so get your songs all ready. I'll just drop the string for you. Won't play any song or anything. Even more important than knowledge is the life of the emotions. A world without delight and without affection is a world destitute of value. These things the scientific manipulator must remember And if he does, his manipulation may be wholly beneficial. All that is needed is that men should not be so intoxicated by the new power as to forget the truths that were familiar to every previous generation. Not all wisdom is new, nor is all folly out of date. Man has been disciplined hitherto by his subjection to nature. Having emancipated himself from the subjection, he is showing something of the defects of slave turned master. A new moral outlook is called for, in which submission to the powers of nature is replaced by respect for what is best in man. It is where this respect is lacking that scientific technique is dangerous. So long as it is present, science, having delivered man from bondage to nature, can proceed to deliver him from bondage to a slavish part of himself, a slavish. The dangers exist, but they are not inevitable, and hope for the future is at least as rational as fear. And that is the very end, right there, folks. The very end. So I guess it's been about 8 weeks. And so many things have come true that I don't know if it's probably prophesized, one would say. He prophesized all this stuff, but he's probably the one that thought of all these ideas, and somebody else put them into effect. Him and other these so-called great thinkers of our time. So I'll see everyone tomorrow with Roger and me show, my show. Until next time, folks.